56A.
Thank you,
John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 56A comes to us from the Senate side with a floor vote of 25 ayes and 5 noes. This prohibits persons from operating a motorboat or idling the motorboat from any persons holding on to or occupies any portion of the boat aft of transom. And it does specify several exemptions, and it also establishes a maximum fine of $360. This bill has no revenue or fiscal impact, but it does have a subsequent referral to judiciary.
And we have Mr. Don Hefner from the Marine Board here to explain the position and tell us why we want to do this. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Marine Board. We requested this bill in the interest of preventing injuries and deaths caused by carbon monoxide poisoning that has been documented by persons that engage in activities that are sometimes referred to as teak surfing or platform dragging. Let me explain. Those are activities where people hold on to the swim platform of a ski boat while they're being towed through the water. There's no rope. They're just holding on to the platform. And sometimes those platforms are made of teak wood, hence the term teak surfing. Another source of concern, people that occupy the swim platform while a boat is at idle. Attached to my testimony, I've included a letter from Captain McGammon of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that documents the nature of this problem and the need for Senate Bill 56. The CDC became involved in this study as an outgrowth of their work on carbon monoxide poisoning associated with houseboats and generators. In their report, they documented 49 severe poisonings, with 17 resulting in death, 19 in loss of consciousness, involving persons occupying swim platforms or teak surfing. One in four of those poisonings took place while occupying the swim platform with the boat at an idle, stationary in the water. As a little science background, carbon monoxide binds to hemoglobin with a binding affinity 200 to 270 times greater than oxygen. With carboxyhemoglobin concentrations in the range of 10 to 20%, symptoms of CO poisoning resemble those of motion sickness or heat exhaustion and include headache, nausea, dizziness, and vomiting. Seizures, coma, and death occur at CO concentrations above 30%. And in the CDC studies, they found concentrations of carboxyhemoglobin in excess of 50% after just minutes of outdoor open-air exposure to boat exhaust. In one case, they documented it involved an 18-year-old boy who drowned after losing consciousness from CO poisoning while teak surfing on Lake Powell during a high school graduation party. He lost consciousness after 5 minutes of exposure while teak surfing, released his grip from the swim platform, and slipped beneath the water and drowned. His body was recovered 3 days later, and his autopsy CO level indicated that more than 51% of his oxygen-carrying molecules had been replaced by CO. The CO concentrations around the swim platform were measured at nearly 27,000 parts per million. In another Lake Shasta, California case, an adult male died within minutes of simply resting on the swim platform with the boat at idle. His autopsy showed 89% of his blood-carrying oxygen molecules had been replaced with poisonous CO. Laws to address this problem have been adopted in Pennsylvania, Nevada, and most recently in the state of California. Last year, the National Association of State Boating Law Administrators adopted a model act to address this issue, and it calls for prohibition on teak surfing or platform dragging and would prohibit occupancy of the swim platform while a boat is at idle, with a few narrow exemptions. We went over this legislation with the Water Sports Industry Association, which promotes water skiing, wakeboarding, and other types of towed water sports. And a letter from them is attached to my testimony as well, supporting the need for this legislation. Fortunately, we have not documented any deaths so far in Oregon due to platform dragging or teak surfing, but we believe, based on the data from the CDC and accident reports from other states, that we should be proactive and it would be prudent to follow their advice and industry recommendations. We feel this bill will promote safe boating practices, combined with efforts to educate and inform the public through our various means of education materials, our website, and other education campaigns. We want to get the word out to people about the dangers of open-air CO poisoning. And I would thank you for your consideration of the bill in the interest of boating safety. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Any questions, sir? Department?
Yes, sir.
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, with regards to this, why doesn't carbon monoxide poisoning affect people that are riding in the boat? I'm not sure I understand the difference between, because they're aft of the transom, aren't they?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, no, they're forward of the transom. The transom is the stern of the technical word for the stern of the boat.
Okay.
And so this is for persons behind that point. People that would be on the swim platform, which is a step okay. sometimes attached to a ski boat, or behind that. Water skiers generally are on a rope that's, you know, 50 to 75 feet in length, so there's enough mixing of carbon monoxide in the open atmosphere that they're not affected by it. Persons in the boat sometimes are affected if you get a station wagon effect, and there actually have been cases where people have gotten carbon monoxide sickness, not fatalities, but the sickness by occupying the seats in the rear of the boat. But generally, if the boat's underway and moving, that's not as much of a problem. But in the area where the swim step is, and they're holding on to that teak surfing, their face is, it would be like sticking your head in front of an exhaust pipe on an automobile. They're within a foot or two of where that exhaust comes out, and it's
okay. And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Is there, one of the things that water ski teachers will use is a ski boom, which is actually off the side of the boat. This would not affect that. This bill would not affect that in any way?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, no, it would not.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dinkfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question regarding outreach for this, Paul, and I have no opposition to the bill, but to me the question is, and you addressed this a little bit in your testimony, to me the key is education. I mean, you can make it illegal, mm-hmm. but unless you get the word out through educational materials and through boating safety classes, people aren't going to know, because unless we have the enforcement capabilities, which I know are quite limited. So can you talk a little bit more about the education component that I'm assuming that your agency will take on, in addition to just increasing the fines for this?
Right. Chairman, Representative Dinkfelder, yeah, our ultimate goal is not criminalizing this and making it a crime and enforcing it, but using that as one part of our means of educating people that it's not only a bad practice, but it's illegal as well. We intend to aggressively pursue education of this through a number of means. Our mandatory education courses and the curriculum that we use for that will include it. Our website, publications, marine officers themselves will be educating people in the field regarding this. So, and then the industry as well, the Water Sports Industry Association, and much of the press that is read by people that engage in wake surfing and boogie boarding and that type of thing. Those those media outlets have been playing to this theme, too.
Okay, thank you.
Don, who will be policing, enforcing this?
Mr. Chairman, we contract with county sheriffs for on-water marine patrol, as well as state police, fish and wildlife enforcement.
The reason I ask that is a concern about the, I mean, this is a reasonably stiff fine with this, $360. And I understand you're not interested in necessarily the fine part of this. You're interested in the health and public safety issue. However, as the measure is drafted right now, it would leave the boating public, open to immediate $360 fines as soon as the bill becomes enacted. And what kind of assurances do we have that this isn't going to become, I realize that one of the fastest ways to get an education is to get a $360 fine. That's not, I think, what I hear, the way I think I hear you wanting to do this. Is there, since you're not going to be the policing agency, I can't really put anything here in the record that the Marine Board is going to be lenient in their first year, since it's not the Marine Board that's going to be involved in it. So how do I handle that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the law enforcement providers are under contract with the Marine Board, and they look very, very seriously to us, very closely to us.
Okay.
For guidance and direction on these types of things. We provide the training to them as well as their operating funding. So we have a close working relationship with those.
So I assume if I put something on the record without bothering to amend the bill, but just put something on the record that you would be considering that as you contract with the local sheriff's offices. Very good.
I might add that I'm sure we'll have that discussion with the Judiciary Committee, where this has a subsequent referral if it moves from this committee.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions for Don? Seeing no one else signed up for...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
One other question, if I may.
One question. Yes.
Paul, the second part of the bill, or second part, in Section 3... It's listing some Class D violations, Class C violations, Class B and Class A, and then a Class B misdemeanor and Class A misdemeanor. Can you tell me what the difference is?
I know.
I mean, when would a person be cited for committing a Class A misdemeanor versus a Class Class C violation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, when legislative council drafted this, they rewrote our entire penalty section, all of ORS 83990 for style. So they're not changing or any of our other classes of violation. Most of our violations are Class B violations. And that's where this would fall. This bill makes a violation of this a Class B. We have some C's and D's, a few A's. The A's are generally reckless and unsafe operation, as well as when that gets into misdemeanors. But they included all these sections because they were amending 990, and they did some editorializing in there. Does that help answer your question?
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. I'll get the name right this time. My apologies. With that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 56, and we would look to come back probably on Monday with the work session on Senate Bill 56. And at this point, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 896A. And Senator Starr is here to enlighten us about Senate Bill 896A. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you. For the record, I'm Bruce Starr, State Senator, Senate District 15, representing the communities in Western Washington County of North Plains, Cornelius, Forest Grove, and Hillsborough. I appreciate the opportunity today to testify in support of Senate Bill 896. 896 is a very simple bill. What it will do is it will encourage an Oregon industry to be born, or should I say reborn. Oregon, and Portland particularly, has a long history of being a shipbuilding city. But with a few exceptions, that's just it. It's just history. There's very, very little actual shipbuilding other than state-of-the-art barge crafts that are being built in Portland. There's capacity. There's dormant facilities waiting for a new opportunity. The genesis of Senate Bill 896, and you have a typo in your testimony. It says 866, and I'm not sure why I did that, but I did. But it's Senate Bill 896. It's born out of discussions with some business folks in the Portland area who have an idea to create and build a new business in Portland. The business is one of building vessels to transport people via the water, water transit vessels. I've included a concept drawing of one of those vessels with my testimony. These vessels are currently being built on the East Coast, but could easily be built here. The question is, are we interested in having them built here? And if we are we interested in providing a small incentive to help leverage the significant investment in private capital that would need to be made in order to bring the businesses here? The vessels that you see in that concept drawing could easily be used on the Willamette River, the Columbia River, Puget Sound, San Francisco Bay, or numerous other places where you basically have a closed area, a small area of water. As a transportation guy, I'm most interested in bringing these particular vessels to Portland because one morning I stood on the bank of the Willamette River in downtown Portland at rush hour and watched the river. I didn't watch very long because it was pretty boring because all you saw was water moving. You didn't see a lot of vehicle traffic or vessels traveling the Willamette River. You have virtually unlimited capacity there. Whereas the freeways in the Portland metropolitan area during the rush hour are jammed, congested, polluting the air because you got cars that are sitting in congested highways. Even the buses that folks use are sitting in that same traffic. What we're talking about here is, one, providing an opportunity. This bill is about manufacturing of these vessels, and there's a huge opportunity here. But my long-term vision is let's not only build them here, but let's use them here as well. And these vessels are ones that can, we're basically building what would be called fast ferries. And these vessels can travel quite quickly, and because of the increase in the kind of technology that's available today, they can travel quickly without creating a wake. And Mr. Chair, I apologize for not having additional testimony, but the gentleman that I'm working with is actually just called me, and he just now landed in Washington, D.C. on a business trip back to D.C., so he's unavailable to testify. But these vessels are being built currently on the East Coast. There's a huge market for them here on the West Coast. We might as well take advantage of that. This provides a $2,500 tax credit maximum, or 15% of payroll, whichever is less, as a tax credit for a vehicle vessel manufacturer. It's that simple. It's not real complicated. It's not a huge hit. We don't expect to recruit 20 of these companies. In fact, we'll probably get one. But I think it still is an impressive opportunity for Oregon and for the Portland area. And on the short term, because you're going to create jobs and economic opportunities and put for the facilities that really aren't being utilized today to use. But in the long term, my goal is to help alleviate some of our traffic congestion problems and move people with these particular vessels in and throughout the Portland metropolitan area. You could easily pick people up in Vancouver and in 20 minutes have them in downtown Portland and beyond. It's pretty exciting. As I've learned more and more about the opportunities here, I become more excited about it. But this is just really a bill that would create an incentive so these companies would want to come and operate here. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions. And other than that, I'd urge the committee. This bill, I believe, has a subsequent referral to revenue, which because it's a credit, tax credit here. I'd love it if you would work the bill and send it on to the Revenue Committee so we can get it on through the process. Appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for appearing today, Senator. Appreciate seeing you again. Senator, you say most of these vehicles are built on the East Coast. Do they provide tax credits for these?
I have no idea. Don't know.
Follow-up. Would there be any guarantee that if such a vehicle were built in the in Oregon, that it would be used in Oregon?
No, and that's we wouldn't expect it to be. We want to bring the manufacturer to Oregon. Let's put Oregonians to work. Let's do the kind of things to create an industry here. But why would we want to limit that opportunity for them to only sell them to an Oregon company and utilize them here when there's huge need, huge opportunities in the the San Francisco Bay Area, Puget Sound, Vancouver, British Columbia, a number of places could use these vessels. I think there's a huge opportunity, but I wouldn't want to limit it so that they would have to sell them to some operator in Oregon.
Follow up. Senator, my son-in-law is a boat builder, and this is just a hypothetical question perhaps, but I can imagine somebody coming to his business and saying that they are building a boat for water transit and getting the $2,500 tax credit and either using it for something else or using it for transit vessels somewhere else. Do you have a response to that?
Well, we do put some, we put some limitations in the bill itself related to these are new employers, new employees, not for an existing. I'd have to look at the bill really fast to find that piece of this. But it's pretty limited. The other piece is we could we've talked about this is to include a more strict definition of water transit vessel to include, you know, a passenger size or passenger limit, so that it would, you know, your manufacturer of the fishing vessels. You know, we've got a number of those in Oregon today wouldn't necessarily qualify for this particular credit.
Follow up. Can you show me? Why couldn't someone just say, I'm going to be using this vessel for water transit, and they could use it for personal use or travel around the world or whatever? So how could that be excluded?
That's not the purpose of the tax credit. My guess is that somebody would have to keep an eye on and enforce the credit to make sure that they're actually using the vessels for water transit and not some personal luxury craft that was sailing around the world. It says here in Section 1, it's used in the section, water transit vessel means a vessel for passengers and vehicles or passengers.
What line is that?
That's in line 4.
Thank you.
So there is a definition there about what it is, what a water transit vessel is. We could tighten that up a bit more if necessary to include a certain number of passengers so that it wasn't just any vessel that was on a regular schedule and charged a fee, a published fee. I mean, we could, you know, the diagram I gave you basically shows a vessel that would carry 100 folks. know, like we could put that in there if that was a concern. I don't think that this is a situation that is going to require a whole lot of policing, quite honestly.
Follow up. I guess I'm just not secure. Yeah.
Follow up.
Thank you. I guess I just don't feel assured that anybody couldn't say that that's what they're doing and just use this as a $2,500 gift.
Okay. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Interesting concept, Senator. You mentioned that the tax credit would be $2,500 or 15% of wages paid to employees, whichever is less. And I see that on line 17 through 20.
Mm-hmm.
Is that per employee,
mm-hmm.
or is that for total?
It would be total.
That would be total?
Paid to employees. But you know, you could quickly get to $2,500 in that subsection. I think that's the cap is really what comes into play.
Well, follow up if I may, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I'm just trying to figure out if that's how much of an incentive is that for a company to, you know, locate a plant. Because it's probably going to cost a boatload of money to locate a plant and hire employees and that sort of thing. And if their incentive to come here is, you know, $2,500 or 15% of what they can pay their employees, whichever is less, and it doesn't take very long to get to $2,500, you're right.
It's not much of it. It's pretty modest.
It's very modest.
I understand that.
Do we have... Have you talked with any companies that are sort of saying, "Yeah, you know, throw us a little bone here, and we'll certainly consider Oregon on our list"?
I personally have not, but I am working with the president of the American Waterways Inc. out of Portland, that's the company that runs the Portland Spirit dinner cruises, and they have talked to a manufacturing. A group or an individual that has expressed interest, and the reality is what's in this bill is very modest, and recognizing kind of the fiscal situation that we're faced with, and working with the senator chairman of the Senate Revenue Committee, we needed to keep the tax credit to be pretty modest in order to move the bill through the process. It seems to be that the very fact that Oregon is looking at this is trying to come up with something that is would incent that pretty significant investment seems to have piqued some interest. Is it enough? Well, I hope it is. You know, and it might be something where we contemplate something more. But I think at this point, the bill as it's printed, the bill as it passed almost unanimously on the Senate floor, has that $2,500 cap, and it's a pretty modest incentive.
So, Mr. Chair, it's almost going to be more to process the paperwork. it is for the credit, but I appreciate the bill cut you bringing it forward. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Seeing no one else signed up for Senate Bill 896, we will thank Senator Starr for bringing this to us. So we'll look forward to a work session on it a week from Wednesday, a week from today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. For that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 896, and we will open the public hearing on House Bill 696. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 696 comes to us from the Senate floor with a vote of 26 ayes, no noes, and 4 excused. This is allowing the Board of Directors of Irrigation Districts to deny petitions for exclusion under certain circumstances. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage. We're trying to get Senator Beyer. Senator Beyer is in committee right now, and we just put a call in. So, but other
is there anyone else signed up to testify? Sandy?
I can't believe so. Oh, yes, there is.
Thank you.
And the bill has no revenue impact or fiscal impact, and there's no subsequent referral on the bill.
Okay. Christina, you want to come up?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, I'm Christina McNitt, representing the Oregon Water Resources Congress. Again, we're a statewide trade association primarily of local districts, specifically organized to deliver irrigation water. Senate Bill 696 provides for a board of directors of an irrigation district the discretion to deny a petition for exclusion if the lands in question are not subject to or are no longer made subject to the charges and assessments of the district. What is a petition for exclusion? A district patron may request to have his or her land excluded from an irrigation district exterior boundary as a means of ending his or her relationship with the district. An exclusion is usually requested when the patron no longer requires the services, no longer wants to receive the water, or otherwise be subject to the charges and assessments of the district. The current process in statute gives the irrigation districts no discretion when acting on an exclusion request, which physically then requires the district to redraw the exterior district boundaries. Senate Bill 696 would allow the district to satisfy the needs of the petitioning patron by ending the irrigation deliveries as well as the assessments, but would keep the exterior boundaries of the district intact and the property eligible to receive irrigation water in the future. Senate Bill 696 was drafted at the request of the Oregon Water Resources Congress with the intent of allowing administrative discretion to districts operating under the exclusion statutes for two primary purposes, the first being reducing administrative processes, so after an exclusion you don't have to go back through an inclusion process if a future or subsequent owner is interested in receiving irrigation water, and secondarily for eliminating unnecessary costs for both the district and the irrigators, and that would be the cost and the expense of going through a mapping process. In summary, if a patron and a district can satisfy each other short of a formal exclusion by way of an agreement where the patron will not receive irrigation water and therefore they're protected from the district applying charges or levying assessments, and the patron pays off whatever existing obligations may exist, then we would like to see the statute provide flexibility to the district so that they can avoid the unnecessary costs of redefining their boundaries.
Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 9. I introduced Senate Bill 696 at the request of a constituent group in my district, the East Valley Water Irrigation District, I think it's the technical name, of which Ms. McNitt is the administrator of the said group. So because she came up in front of me, about all I have left to say is what she said. I'd be happy to answer any questions if I could.
Thank you and welcome. Appreciate your coming over from a busy schedule. And with that, are there any questions for Senator Beyer? Yes.
Thank
please,
you.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Birthday Boy. Senator, was there any opposition to this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, when we had the first hearing on the bill,
some questions were raised, and but I can't recall now. Did we amend the bill? I'm trying to think. I can't remember off the top of my head if we amended the bill. It seems like we were able to just answer the questions, and no one said anything after
no
that.
Amendments.
No amendments. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and as we will discover, that probably isn't going to hold up since I have some people who have signed up to testify in opposition to the bill. So, but that was to be a secret, and but I've just left the secret out, I guess.
I'll be anxious to hear it, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Roger. I appreciate your coming over. Appreciate you bringing the bill forward for your constituents.
Thanks for having a public hearing, and hopefully we can move the bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Christina.
Thank you.
Okay, and we have then Glenn Stonebrink and Emily Wolf. And since you're both on somewhat the same side, I assume I can trust that you won't have confrontations at the table there, and we can proceed with it. Good afternoon, Mr. Stonebrink, please.
For the record, Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen Association. Happy birthday, Mr. Chairman. I hope you have many, many, many more, and many,
thank
many
you.
More as chairman of the Water Committee. As was stated, this bill is to change the authority of an irrigation district board, which currently cannot deny a petition. Current law says they must accept a petition from someone who wants out of an irrigation district. They're not receiving any water. They simply want their land to be removed from an irrigation district. Current law says that they can only approve it, but approve it according to certain requirements or approve it without any condition. Anytime I look at legislation, and what caught my eye with this one is, why? What is the reason? There must be a reason. And when I testified in the Senate, I basically asked the question, what's the reason? And I heard the reasons today given by Christina McNett, but they aren't there. Here's what she said. It would cost the district money. They'd have to redraw these maps. Now, first of all, if I see a map of the land and there's a boundary around there and someone wants to be out of that boundary, to me it's very simple to go to the map and draw their boundary and color it different than you did before. But maybe it's not that simple. Let's say that there really are some costs and they have to officially redraw that. If you go to line 22 of the bill, and this is talking about the irrigation board, as a condition of exclusion, may require the petitioner to pay all costs of exclusion, including but not limited to recording fees and reasonable administrative fees and so on. So if it's administrative cost, this is current law right now that allows them to do that. But what this bill does do is allow a board to simply use the term, well, it's not administratively convenient to let you out, therefore we're not going to let you out. Your property must remain in a government entity. They don't want their property to be there. So I have made phone calls to our people within the Cattlemen Association. There's a lot of them who their land is in an irrigation district. They have they work with an irrigation district. And I said, okay, suppose this was you, and you no longer receive water, no services from the district. Would you want this bill to pass to say that district can force you to keep your land in there? And he said, absolutely not. What, for what reason? I said, I can't answer it either. But the only reasons given are the cost, and they're not here, plus the fact there is no definition of what administrative convenience really means, so it could mean anything. It's a private property issue. We'd ask you to vote no on this bill.
Questions for Glenn? Thank you, Glenn. Emily?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And happy birthday as well.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, we would echo the Oregon Cattlemen's Association's concerns with this bill and just point out one more thing specifically, that not only is administrative convenience not defined, districts not only already have...
Excuse me, you need your name for the
record. I'm sorry, of course. Emily Wolf with Water for Life for the record. As Mr. Stonebrink pointed out, petitioners may already pay all the administrative fees required by exclusion by an exclusion process. I would also point out as well that districts should serve their members and that statute already provides them a venue for continuing to offer the services needed to the rest of their members, even if this land that's at this point subject to exclusion is taken out of the district, which is not receiving district services. If this land is not receiving district services, and as lines 25 through 28 already provide, any facilities in the district may be required to, the petitioner must provide measures to protect those facilities, then I don't understand why they wouldn't be really about able to go about business as usual. So I would concur with Mr. Stonebrink that this legislation isn't really necessary. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Ms. Wolf? We got off easy today.
Yes, I did. Thank you.
Okay. Colleagues, we are going to... that's all we have signed up on this bill. We're going to close public hearing at this time on it, and we're going to pursue some discussions during the next week or so on this bill before we bring it back for a work session or any further action. And with that, Senate Bill 696, public hearing is closed, and we're going to... at this juncture open our informational meeting reviewing the Klamath Basin adjudication, and we do have I think, do I have a sign up sheet on there?
No.
Invited. Oh, all right. The Department Water Resources, Phil Ward, and I assume you want to bring some other folks? Okay. Right. Reed Marbit with Water Resource Department. Please proceed, whoever's...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll start it out. For the record, Phil Ward with the department. And with me today, as you've identified, is Reed Marbit. Reed is the only person, Mr. Chair, that I've ever met that has been licensed to practice both veterinary medicine and law. And so I'm delighted to have him with me today to help keep me on the straight and narrow. Mr. Chairman, a week or so ago you had an informational hearing on the Klamath Basin adjudication, and at that time you asked the department to come back to provide its perspective on some of the things that were said and its general perspective on the adjudication. What I'd like to do briefly with you all today is address four items. One, I'd like to talk just quickly about adjudication generally, what that is. Secondly, I'd like to specifically discuss Oregon's adjudication law. Thirdly, I'd like to spend a little time again specifically discussing the Klamath Basin adjudication. And finally, I'd like to address a couple of the specific topics that were raised on your hearing during your hearing on April 27th. Certainly, an adjudication is an activity that's critical to property right owners with vested water rights, because an adjudication establishes the relative priority of water rights in the area being adjudicated, and for a state like Oregon, that's obviously extremely critical when you function according to a prior appropriation doctrine. The other thing an adjudication does that's critical is that it makes the state's suite of water management tools available in that area. In other words, it brings state law into bear. Every western state, essentially, has undertaken an adjudication of their stream basins. Most of these states do it a little differently than we do in Oregon. They do what we would call a judicial adjudication. And in that type of adjudication, all the stages of the adjudication are essentially civil litigation conducted in the civil court. Oregon, back in 1909, took a slightly different course. The Oregon adjudication system is essentially an administrative proceeding in its early stages. The theory behind that is that it will be much less formal, theoretically less costly, to the participants than judicial proceedings. Claimants can appear in Oregon's adjudication system without an attorney. You can bring hearsay evidence into an Oregon adjudication, which frankly is important because we are adjudicating rights that are claimed back over 100 years ago at times, and so you need the opportunity to bring some of that anecdotal evidence into the system. Oregon's system has been tested in the courts, as you can imagine, and has been found to be constitutionally sound. Our law was enacted in 1909, and our law became the basis of the adjudication systems in several of our neighboring states. Arizona, Nevada, California, Texas, all have based their systems on Oregon's. Essentially, persons claiming a vested water right in our state have to file a proof of claim. The director reviews these claims, ultimately prepares a finding of fact and a determination, which is then filed with the circuit court. The court then reviews the director's determination and enters a final judgment that takes the form of a decree. Two-thirds of the water basins in Oregon have been adjudicated at this point, and currently the Klamath Basin adjudication is the only active adjudication underway in our state. It's often been suggested, sometimes by people in our office, that the Klamath Basin has produced the perfect storm in terms of water issues. Certainly, I think it's acknowledged that water demand in the Klamath Basin outstrips supply. The Klamath Basin has a very well-known endangered species conflict active. There's a complexity of multiple federal interests in the Klamath Basin, including both upper and lower basin tribal rights. It's a basin that spans two separate states. And certainly the current PacifiCorp hydro relicensing activity, when you add all those things together, it creates an extremely complex situation in our view. One of the key issues in the Klamath Basin today is that the department cannot regulate water users until this adjudication is complete, until the rights have been quantified and documented. This adjudication began in 1975. It was postponed by two federal lawsuits, so the claiming period was finally finished in this adjudication in 97. There were over 700 claims filed for water rights in this adjudication. 5,600 of these claims, there were contests filed, so there was a dispute over 5,600 in 5,600 cases. But to date, 87% of these contests have been resolved. However, as you would guess, some of the more complex and difficult contests remain. The department is very much committed to the completion of the Klamath Basin adjudication. Delay of these cases that are still pending could seriously impact the entire remaining hearing schedule. But the department is extremely sensitive to some of the concerns you heard expressed on the 27th relative to the heavy burden on parties to meet the hearing schedule and the briefing schedules. In fact, we're working today to find some flexibility in a bit of that in a bit of that schedule. Additionally, the department's been extremely active in support of a couple settlement discussions that are underway that you heard a little bit about on the 27th. The former Senator Steve Harper has been facilitating, and former director of the department, Martha Pagel's been mediating some of these discussions in Klamath, in the Klamath Basin recently. And the department's been supportive of those settlement discussions and, in fact, has served as a technical consultant to the folks attempting to resolve their contests. So in that generally on the basin, Mr. Chair, I'd like to address specifically a couple of the things that came forward on April 27th. One is the issue of whether we should have included Federal Reserve rights at all in the Klamath Basin adjudication. It's true that the department could have elected, back when this thing began, not to include the federal claims, not to require the federal government to file claims. It would have meant, frankly, if we had done that, conducting adjudication without involving any of those Federal Reserve right claims, claims by the National Park Service, by Crater Lake, by the Forest Service, by the National or by the National Forests that are in the Klamath Basin, the Fish and Wildlife claims, and all the tribal claims, if we had elected to go that direction, would have been left out. So what would this have meant if we had made that choice? Frankly, it would have resulted in a partial resolution of the issues in that basin. And in our view, it would have left ultimately the state adjudicated rights vulnerable to future action by the federal claimants. It was our view that the benefits of including the federal claims in the adjudication far outweighed the risks. We understood, I think the department at that time understood well, that moving in this direction would be both complex and expensive, would generate significant legal conflict, but we felt that the state adjudication was a better forum for Oregonians to resolve these issues than the federal courts. Again, we're confident that the alternative, refusing the federal claims, would have quickly led to a federal adjudication. And certainly, we've had this concern confirmed by some subsequent actions by parties in federal court. Again, it's our view the federal court adjudication would likely have far exceeded the cost of a state adjudication proceeding.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question, please, before we proceed?
Representative Tomei.
I'm trying to read along as you speak, and on page 3, one paragraph up from the bottom one, including the rights to the project. What project are you referring to?
My apologies, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei. That's what we would call the Klamath Basin Irrigation Project, which was established 1905, as a Federal Bureau of Reclamation project to provide irrigation water to farmers in the Klamath Basin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Proceed, please.
Mr. Chair, that takes me to the top of page 4. And again, I just would iterate before we leave the issue of the federal claims, given the fact that the federal claimants have certainly indicated their willingness to pursue this issue in federal court, we believe ultimately that the decision to require federal claims in the Klamath adjudication was the correct decision to make. The next issue I'd like to address just quickly.
Excuse me, Phil.
Yes, sir.
When you're referring to, is it Barron? Is that the pronunciation case? You're making an absolute statement that if we had not elected to include the federal and tribal claims, the federal court would not have been dismissed. The case Barron would not have been dismissed. What's the basis of making that statement?
Well, we certainly believe that to be the case, Mr. Chair, and I guess I'd ask Reed to address kind of the
difference between believe it and what is said here. That's
certainly
why I'm asking. Please.
Chairman Jensen, Reed Marbot with the Water Resources Department, for the record. The argument that the state of there were a number of parties to the Barron case when it started. It was a reopening of the old Adair case, which started in 1975 and was finally completed in 1986. The court in that case, the district court in Portland, federal district court in Portland, retained jurisdiction of the case during the time when the state was going to be performing its adjudication. In case any of the parties wish to return to that court for further interpretation of the order in Adair. And in midstream in our process, the federal government, the United States Department of Justice and the Klamath Tribe, felt that the adjudication was not following the concept that they had envisioned, and went back to the judge in the Adair case, a different judge, same court, and asked the judge for an order making certain declarations about the original Adair case. The state of Oregon intervened in that case and petitioned the court, or motion moved to the court, that the court should dismiss the case given the fact that there was an ongoing state adjudication. The federal district court in Portland heard that argument and denied it, heard the case on the merits, and came out with the order that it found that it needed to. The state of Oregon appealed that to the Ninth Circuit without ever arguing on the merits. We were prohibited from arguing on the merits simply because the state of Oregon is the independent adjudicator in this matter and couldn't take a side on the issues in any way. We did then go to the Ninth Circuit and argue that since there was an ongoing state adjudication that included the federal rights, that the federal court should have abstained from the case in the first place. The Ninth Circuit Court made a decision in that matter and stated that that is correct, that the federal district court in Portland should not have taken the case, should have abstained from the case, vacated the case, and ordered the federal district court in Portland to not take up the case again until the Klamath adjudication and all its appeals were completed. Now, the theory of the abstention is called in the nomenclature of the law a Colorado River abstention doctrine, and that doctrine holds that where a state is conducting an ongoing adjudication, including the federal rights, but the federal government is prohibited from going into federal court and re-arguing the same issues. It really, the Supreme Court in that case kind of came down and said, for the purposes of judicial economy, fairness to all the parties, you shouldn't have two ongoing processes at the same time, and we should defer to the state process, which they've said in that case, that are much more capable of evaluating the various rights. That's a long story. Sorry about that.
No, it's fine. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Chair, the other issue I wanted to address relative to your April 27th hearing, there was some concern raised during that hearing about whether the department had fulfilled the requirements of ORS 539-120, which requires the department to make an examine of the stream and the works diverting water therefrom used in connection with the water rights subject to this chapter. In other words, when you do an adjudication, you've got to take a look at the landscape, the stream, the irrigation diversion works, all the works associated with the use of the water, as a part of conducting that adjudication. We believe we've fulfilled this requirement both in spirit and in letter, Mr. Chair. We've conducted what we would characterize as four different examinations. The first was completed in 1971 by the State Water Resources Board, which was an analysis of the natural features of the basin, surface water supply, annual runoff, those types of things. That report is available, I think, still at the department. It's over 300 pages in length and contains a significant amount of documentation as a part of the report itself. The second work that we would characterize as an examination was the department's mapping of the irrigation uses in the basin. That occurred between 1979 and 86. The department created over 180 maps delineating water down to the use on each 40-acre parcel for the entire basin. The third examination was what we'd characterize as a composite map of all the water use claimed in the adjudication. This map is revised as the cases to the adjudication are resolved, so as to provide an updated depiction of the status. And then the final The final item we would characterize as an examination of the basin is the water's availability analysis. It's analysis of available water in the Klamath Basin. That can be accessed on our website along with our availability analysis for all the other regions of the state. So, Mr. Chair, I guess I'd just say in conclusion, and certainly Reed and I will be happy to entertain any questions that you might have. We would certainly acknowledge that the Klamath Basin adjudication has been a complex and costly undertaking. However, in our view, Mr. Chair, and I think the numbers would support this, the end's in sight. And if we continue to persevere, the department's committed to a timely completion of this adjudication, which will, in our view, will bring certainty to the parties in terms of their rights to use water in the Klamath Basin, and it will allow the department then to begin to manage water according to Oregon law in this part of our state. So with that, Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to stand for questions.
Are there questions for the department?
I have one. Go to that side first.
Representative Jane Calder.
Thank you. Thank you, Phil, for this excellent explanation. I've been aware of the Klamath situation for over 10 years, and every time I hear a presentation, I learn something new. Can you talk a little bit about the costs of the adjudication and the cost to the state versus to the different parties? For instance, what, you know, I look at how many federal claims there are, and is there any way, I mean, is there a way that we get reimbursed for the federal claims, or how is that allocated?
Mr. Chair, Representative, one of my great dissatisfactions in this whole process is that the federal government, through the federal court decisions that that occurred resulting from the litigation relative to this adjudication, is not required to pay the fees to the department to support this process that a regular landowner is. Is that correct?
That's true.
And so we certainly have felt some chagrin over that issue, since the federal claims are an extremely large piece of the equation. However, that's an issue that's been settled in the courts and is moot as far as our ability to deal with it today. So the costs have been extensive. Representative to the state, we will have spent at the close of this biennium probably over $1 million on the adjudication during the 2003-05 biennium.
Wow.
That
in one biennium?
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
In one biennium?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
So follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative Dingfelder.
And I'm just curious, if we had decided not to include the federal claims in our adjudication, and we'd gone to court, then what would have, I mean, would it, would we have been forced to do it anyway in the scenario that you think under the existing case law? I find that's the thing that's really hard when we look at the cost of the state, and that there's been no cost reimbursement or very little cost reimbursement for the federal claims.
I believe we would have been pursuing this matter in the federal courts at probably a greater cost.
And I have one final question.
Follow up, Representative Dingfelder.
I noticed that we have the Bureau of Indian Affairs has in-stream water rights. It's listed as in-stream, and then the Klamath tribes have a separate set of claims. Can you explain that to me? Is it other tribes that are included in the BIA clumped together, or non-recognized tribes, or is it in-stream versus user claims?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dinkover, Reed Marvitt for the record. The claims by the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the Klamath Basin adjudication are as trustee for the Klamath tribes, and those are the Klamath, Modoc, and Huskin Band of the Snake River tribes, which are the resident, their location is the former Klamath Reservation in the Upper Basin. And those claims by the Bureau of Indian Affairs were simply for the tribe. The reason why we have to put them together is because the tribes, given a case several years ago, excuse me, were required to file their own claims too. So the process was that the Bureau of Indian Affairs did all of the technical legal work to file the claims, and then the Klamath tribes filed five very perfunctory claims saying what they claimed are also our claims.
Mm-hmm.
So that at some point, if the United States government decided to go one direction and the tribe didn't agree, they could have their own case. But they are simply for the Klamath tribes, no other tribes.
Okay. Thank you. Clarification.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ward, you were saying at a greater cost to the state. Is that what you meant? Thank you.
That's
more
correct.
Than $1 million per binding.
Mr. Chair, Representative, very possibly.
Thank you.
There are other questions for this? Is there agreement?
Mr. Chair, thank you. We were consulting.
I see Martin, you questioning counsel.
Would like to enlarge upon my answer. That's his euphemism for making sure I'm correct, I think.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the reason why is fairly easy. Now, obviously, we have no way to predict how a federal court case would go. But we have expended many hundreds of thousands of dollars simply defending the process through three cases that went all the way up petition to the United States Supreme Court, and one case, this last one, that stopped at the Ninth Circuit. That case alone, just to do the pleading to get it dismissed, was a little over $50,000. So the participation in federal court by the state of Oregon to protect the rights of the state property holders would have been extreme to the least. Those states who have been subjected to a federal court adjudication of federal water rights have almost all elected, when the opportunity arose, to invoke their own state court adjudication that they can then control in their forum. This would be especially friendly to Oregon, since our system is so administratively heavy to begin with. If we had gone into federal court, and if all the farmers in the basin had to go to federal court to participate in the Portland Federal District Court to adjudicate or to challenge the rights of the federal government, we believe the burden would be extremely greater, larger than the burden that they are bearing to support their own claims in the Klamath. And that's why we speculate, that that would be the case. We'd have two ongoing adjudications, and it would be unbearable to the parties in the case.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may have said, and if you did, I missed it, what the basis is for the claiming of the right to adjudicate at the state level rather than at the federal level. Is there some constitutional principle, or is it a statutory, is it a part of the U.S. Code, or what is it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, I'll read Marvin for the record. Until 1952, states could not adjudicate federal rights. In fact, that's why most of the adjudications in Oregon did not include federal rights, because we had no jurisdiction over the federal government. In 1952, the McCarran Amendment was adopted. The McCarran Amendment is about a very short paragraph and just says that for purposes of general stream adjudications, for suits for general stream adjudication, sovereign immunity of the United States is waived, and the United States is treated like any other party, except they do not have to pay costs. Based upon that amendment, every state in the West has begun adjudications to adjudicate rights, including the federal rights. Oregon followed suit in its 1975 initiation of the Klamath Basin adjudication. There was a degree of uncertainty when that started in 1975 because the Klamath tribal reservation.
You've answered my question, and I appreciate it. The summary is it's the U.S. Code that gives the state the jurisdiction.
That's true.
Through a waiver of sovereign immunity by the federal government. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Phil.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
We have next Bill Ganong. Good afternoon, Bill.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Bill Ganong. I'm an attorney from Klamath Falls. I'm an attorney in private practice, but a large part of my practice is as general counsel for the Klamath Irrigation District. I am a member and representing the Klamath Irrigation District in the adjudication. I'm a member of a team we call the Joint Prosecution Team. The team is made up of about 7 attorneys, a water engineering firm, literally firm, multiple members, a historic research firm that includes 3 members that have worked for us on the Klamath Committee, a hydrologist, and a firm of biologists. That's our team, and most important of all, 5 of the farmer landowner irrigators are part of the team. That's the scope of the people that are involved in prosecuting, taking forward the claim of the irrigation districts and their water users in the Klamath Irrigation Klamath Project. We're over $2 million into this project. And that expenditure is in addition to funds we've expended in other litigation. We have a pending suit in the Federal Court of Claims where we're trying to get reimbursement from the United States for the water that we lost in 2001. We have we're interveners in the relicensing of the Klamath River dams, which in the past have provided preferential power rates not only to the project but to all the irrigators or most of the irrigators in the Klamath Basin. It goes on and on and on and on. Today, the assessments or charges that are paid annually by the farmers in the project, 20 to 30% of their assessment goes to litigation. A good part of it to this litigation, but to litigation. As Mr. Marbot stated, we have a birthday that's occurring. It's Sunday. This coming Sunday, the Klamath Project will be 100 years old. It was authorized on May 15, 1905. And the Klamath Project water users and the Bureau of Reclamation are both gearing up.
I'm being told by my members here to say something to the effect, oh, yes, I remember that.
Mr. Chair, when this adjudication started, I had long, dark hair. It's now gray. I hope I have some hair when it, in fact, I hope I'm alive when it's completed. I recognize that you're much younger than the Klamath Project, but and I wish you a happy birthday. If I may step to the map, I'll orient you a little bit. This map is an exhibit to the Klamath Compact.
We're going to try and get you somewhat over there.
This map is an exhibit to the Klamath Compact. The Klamath Compact was a compact made by the states of Oregon and California and by the United States in the 1950s. At that period of time, there were several issues with respect to the water of the Klamath River, including some attempt to divert Klamath River water to the Sacramento Basin or to use it in California. So the state of Oregon stepped up and moved to protect its water for its water users. To orient you a little bit, from north to south is approximately 80 miles in length. From east to west is about 40 miles. Crater Lake National Park, which is located in Klamath County, Oregon, is up here at the northwest corner. The sources of the water for the Klamath River irrigators are Wood River, which flows through the Wood River Valley, and this is the area that Mr. Nicholson and Mr. McAuliffe farm in or ranch in. The Sprague River system, which flows from the east, from Gearhart Mountain or Lake County, more or less, to the east, and the Williamson River system, which flows from the Klamath Marsh area down into Upper Klamath Lake. Upper Klamath Lake is the primary reservoir for the land that gets water from the Klamath River for irrigation. The Klamath Project is this area south of Klamath Falls, It lies on both sides of the Oregon-California border. There are approximately 170,000 acres of land in the Klamath Project irrigated from the Klamath River. Water flows downhill, and that's the flow here. The flow is from the top of the map to the bottom of the map. Ultimately, the Klamath River leaves the upper basin, goes into a canyon into California, and flows to the Pacific Ocean. As Mr. Ward stated, at this point in time, the use of the water for irrigation in the Klamath Basin is essentially unregulated. State law provides that until the director enters his order in the adjudication, the department lacks authority to regulate water. The impact of that is, if you're at the top of the drainage, and you're the first person to put your straw in the river, and you're not regulated based on your relative priority, you get your water. As the water gets to the bottom, we get what's left over. And for 80 years, that wasn't a bad situation, because there's a lot of water in the upper Klamath Basin. However, with the listing of the sucker fish in the 1988 in Upper Klamath Lake under the Endangered Species Act, and with the listing of the coho salmon in the Klamath River in California downstream from us, we have a regulatory drought that's been put down on top of the Klamath Project. So now the irrigators in the Klamath Project share their water with the endangered species. And in 2001, that meant we had no water. None of the other people share. They get their water before it gets to the lake. We have a federal nexus. We are a federal irrigation project, notwithstanding the fact that most of the land is privately owned, notwithstanding the fact that the facilities that deliver the water, the canals, headgates, pumps, drains, are operated by Oregon Irrigation Districts, Oregon Improvement Districts, regulated directors are landowners. We are a federal project, and so when water is needed for a federal purpose, such as the Endangered Species Act, to this point in time, it's come out of our supply. To a great extent, we share the frustration and concerns that Mr. Nicholson and Mr. McAuliffe described for you. This is a phenomenally expensive project. It's expensive in terms of dollars. It's expensive in terms of emotions. It's a very difficult, trying process that we are in today. However, I'm going to be the last person that's going to be critical of the process. The process is reflective of all of us. Had I appreciated the changes or the nuances that this process was going to take at the beginning, I would have done my job differently. And my colleagues share that feeling. We would have provided different information at the very beginning of the process. We would have gone about our jobs differently. The legislature is part of the reason for the process. Every 2 years, the department's been in asking for money for the Klamath adjudication, and the legislature has provided money. However, it hasn't provided the optimum amount necessary to do the job. And I'm not being critical. I appreciate the incredible job you have in allocating resources that you don't have. We have the same problem. Where do we spend our money? In addition, during the process, the Office of Administrative Hearings was established. And in that process, the department came into the legislature and asked to be exempt from the hearings the General Hearings Office representation. They told the legislature that water rights issues are an issue of expertise, and it could be done more efficiently by in-house administrative law judges. After testimony and debate, and for good reason, the legislature decided not to exempt the department. So as Mr. Nicholson described, the hearings officers for this case, and I believe there have been 8 to date. There's only one hearings officer, administrative law judge, Judge Russell, that's been with us the entire time. And the impact of that is that there's a turnover in that office. And each time it turns over, the new judges, and they're doing a great job. They're doing the best job they can, but their learning curve is a vertical wall. They have to learn water law from scratch, and that's not an easy thing to do. And it's costing the state thousands and thousands of dollars because you have to educate those people so they can then make an informed and intelligent decision. As you recognized and Mr. Ward described, the federal government's part of the process. They're not paying any of the cost. They are not paying any of the cost. When I filed the claims for the Klamath Project, I delivered over $170,000 in filing fees with our claims. The federal government didn't deliver a penny. There doesn't seem to be anybody in the federal government that can make a decision. The state tried to do an alternate dispute resolution process to try and negotiate some of these claims at the beginning. There was no one from the federal government that would come or with the authority to make a deal. For 2 years, the Federal Department of Justice argued over procedural rules. We could not get ground rules established.
Thank you. I have a question regarding, I know several years back, Senator Hatfield put together a bi-state, I believe it was bi-state, commission. What was the fate, what happened, what was the outcome of that process?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelder, my understanding it didn't go, was it never moved forward. In addition, both Representative Walden and Senator Wyden and Senator Smith at times have tried to get money from the federal government for the adjudication. That it hasn't made its way through Congress, and so we're still with a adjudication funded by the state, funded by the non-federal participants, and one that's focused strictly on the Klamath Basin in Oregon. Doesn't include California.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to, maybe I can hear from the department as well, because I recall that there were meetings, but maybe it was another group, because I thought there was some type of bi-state. Maybe it was a policy and not an adjudication process.
But Representative
I
Jensen.
I think Reed's running up.
Okay. Representative Dingfelder, we have what's called the Hatfield Committee. And the purpose of the Hatfield Committee is to look at restoration efforts in the Klamath Basin. And they do have some money that they have invested in that process. It's not a committee intended to find a resolution or a settlement of water rights. It's a committee whose focus is restoration projects.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, read my for the record. That's correct. The Hatfield Committee was established for the purposes of habitat restoration, not for participation or assistance with the adjudication. I think the federal government's position on that was this is litigation and we can't get involved in that kind of thing.
Follow up for Reed?
Follow
up. Well, the question I have, Reed, is I would imagine that the in-stream water rights were a big part of the restoration, so I'm just curious how they managed to get around that, because that would be a big part of the habitat restoration focus. So, is that process still ongoing?
I think the Hatfield Group is still working and is still funded. It continues
There's
to work on
that. A lot of head shaking behind you. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelder, if I may add to that, the Hatfield Group is ongoing. If in-stream water rights are a focus of that group, they have not gained any transfer of in-stream water rights. And the major problem, or a major problem, is until your right is adjudicated, the law has no mechanism for transferring that right. Today, the Bureau of Reclamation has funded set-aside programs where farmers are setting aside their land or agreeing not to divert water. That's adding water to the system. The Bureau is paying for people to pump groundwater rather than use surface water. That's adding water to the system. But in terms of a permanent transfer of water right or increase in in-stream flows, that really can't happen until there's an adjudication complete and we can transfer those rights under the state law.
Thank you.
Thank you. How much do you have?
About five more minutes, sir? And then I'll cut it short.
as difficult as the process has been and is, it's better than the alternatives. Mr. Ward described some federal reserved rights, Forest Service, Park Service, those types of rights. He left out one major one, and that is the Federal Reserve right, which we call a Walton right. A Walton right is the water right that a non-Indian landowner receives when he or she succeeds an Indian allottee. So it's land that was on the Klamath Reservation that has water rights under the Klamath Treaty. Those water rights under the Adair case and the Walton case flow through to the non-Indian landowner.
The Klamath Indian Reservation is this dotted line. And so all of this land on the Williamson River, all of the land on the Sprague River that Mr. Bartell represents, those are Walton rights. If you exempt federal or had exempted Federal Reserve rights from this adjudication, those rights would have been exempted also. The McCarran Act waives sovereign immunity and allows the state to resolve federal water rights only if the adjudication is a comprehensive adjudication. And comprehensive means includes all claims. When the U.S. sued Oregon in Oregon, or U.S. versus Oregon, the U.S. alleged that this adjudication is not a comprehensive adjudication because it doesn't include groundwater. And the federal court disagreed with that and said, since it includes all the surface water, we think it's comprehensive. So if you move to take out any of the federal rights, you would not have a comprehensive adjudication. You would not have jurisdiction over the Bureau of Reclamation and some of the Klamath Project rights, my client's rights. If you don't have the federal government, then you have what happened to us in the Klamath Basin in the Lost River adjudication. The Lost River decree was entered in 1918. The federal government was not part of that litigation or that adjudication because the state didn't have jurisdiction. The landowners out there have requested from the department water rights certificates in, you know, that comply with the decree. And the circuit court in Klamath County and the department have both agreed that adjudication isn't complete. The decree's been there for 100 years or 90 years, but it's not complete because the federal government wasn't involved. We're going to have to redo that or at least do a supplemental to look at federal rights. A federal court adjudication is even worse. Mr. Marbot described the cost in just three pieces of federal litigation. In 1905, the Newlands Project in Nevada was authorized, Newlands Reclamation Project in the Carson, Reno area on the Truckee and Carson Rivers. In 1913, the United States filed a suit to adjudicate those rights. That adjudication is going on in federal court. There have literally been hundreds of interim court decisions, including a U.S. Supreme Court decision. The case bounces back and forth between the federal court and the state court because the federal court, when it gets to a question of state law, refers it to the state court for a decision, and then it comes back to the federal court. Hopefully, this adjudication will be done in another 15 or 20 years or less, and maybe I'm being optimistic, but it will be done more efficiently, cheaper, and faster than a federal court adjudication. Delaying the adjudication is not an answer. We all have a huge investment in this process. If we stop it now, it's likely the federal courts will then step back in and adjudicate at least the tribal rights and maybe some of the other rights, and we'll be in that process. Further, our experience is timelines push parties to find resolution. There have been a number of the claims that have been settled in this matter. They've been settled shortly before the hearing, or during the hearing or shortly after the hearing, in order to avoid what might be an adverse decision one way or the other, in order to avoid the additional costs. If you delay the adjudication, you're going to delay settlement of further claims. And then finally, your perspective is based on whether you're getting water or not. And quite frankly, for the folks that are upstream that are getting water and aren't regulated, nearly any decision in the adjudication is going to be a bad decision. It's going to put some kind of limits on their use of the water. When you're at the bottom of the system like we are and you've actually lost your water completely, almost any decision is a good decision because it's going to limit your use, but it's going to give you a right that you can show to a court and say, and to an administrator and say, here's my right, please deliver my water. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Bill. We have then John DeVoe and Doug Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Doug Myers, and I'm not representing Water Watch.
I saw that.
Here today is John DeVoe, who is Executive Director of Water Watch, and with that.
Thanks, Doug. Thank you, Chair Jensen and the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to come today. I'm the Executive Director of Water Watch. We are a nonprofit river conservation group dedicated to protecting and restoring natural flows in Oregon's rivers. As you've heard, the Klamath Basin faces... I'm sorry, I'm John DeVoe, Executive Director of Water Watch. The Klamath Basin faces an unprecedented crisis. The adjudication is one element of that crisis. The basin's waterways have become severely depleted and polluted over many years. The fundamental root of the problem is that federal and state officials have promised too much water to too many interests. Even in a good water year, there is simply not enough water to go around and to satisfy all of the legitimate claims to water in the basin. Now, the state has said that until the adjudication is complete, its hands are essentially tied in the basin. Yet there are things the state could be doing. Since 2002, when we had the massive fish kill on the Klamath River, the state of Oregon has issued almost 100 new permanent water rights in the Klamath Basin for approximately 300 cubic feet per second of water. We find evidence of overallocation in the basin wherever we look, including severely declining fish and wildlife populations, listing of aquatic species under the Endangered Species Act, a failure to meet tribal treaty and trust responsibilities and to provide for subsistence fisheries for tribes in the basin. We see economic harm to upper basin agricultural communities and to communities that depend on commercial fishing. The Klamath River historically had the third largest salmon runs on the West Coast. It supported a large commercial fishing operation from Fort Bragg, California to Coos Bay, Oregon. As a result of fish kills in 2002, both adult returning and juvenile outgoing, the salmon fishery in that area has essentially been closed this year, and the estimate is that the economic harm from that will be about $30 million this year. That will be felt on the coast of Oregon. We've also seen a failure to meet the water needs of the basin's wildlife refuges, which are six of the most important ones in the entire federal system. So even though the basin is obviously over-allocated and over-promised, the state has continued to issue new water permits and water rights, thus continuing a practice that has been a major factor in creating the water crisis. In 2002, a number of groups petitioned the Water Resources Commission to close the basin to further appropriation. The commission refused to close the basin, and since then we've seen these new water rights issued. In addition to the new water rights that have issued, there are about 21 applications pending for new permits, one of which is for a very large 149,000-plus acre-foot reservoir that would capture flows from the Klamath River. This is an application by the Klamath Drainage District to create two reservoirs now. The state of Oregon has said the water is available for this project. And we find under the circumstances that that is somewhat incredible. Also, the continued permitting of new long-term groundwater and surface water uses fuels the flames of conflict in the basin. It diminishes the ability of the state and the federal government to respond to drought and undercuts water conservation efforts of many in the upper basin who are taking these steps, including water districts, irrigators, and agencies. Given the known hydraulic connection between surface waters and groundwaters in the basin, granting these new groundwater rights on a permanent basis is really robbing Peter to pay Paul, and we will see diminished surface flows in the future as a result of continued allocation of groundwater. The state's actions to permanently allocate water by granting new permits is at odds with its continued acknowledgement that, quote, while groundwater helped farmers survive the drought of 2001, it can't replace surface water year in and year out and must be managed on a sustainable basis, end quote. Thus, we need to preserve the remaining groundwater resources of the basin for drought year emergencies such as we're experiencing this year, rather than permanently allocating it and losing the cushion that groundwater has provided in the past. I am not an expert on the procedure and history of the Klamath adjudication, but I do know, and the department knows as well, that completing the adjudication will not result in more water in the Klamath Basin. Clearly, the adjudication is important for long-term water management in the basin, but it will never provide more water than nature provides to the basin. Thus, while the adjudication is a positive step for cleaning up water management in the basin, it will not relieve the problems caused by over-allocation of basin water. If the adjudication is incomplete, the department is not in a position to know if there is unallocated water available for future appropriation. Until the amount of water that can be legally diverted is known, Water Watch believes it is irresponsible to approve more non-emergency applications for water. Without knowing as a practical matter whether water to fulfill those permits exist, we believe the department's current actions in issuing new permits are simply exacerbating the problem. Specific to the adjudication, I would like to note that Water Watch believes an excessive rate and duty are being awarded in cases in the adjudication. Our understanding is that the typical rate and duty awarded in the adjudication are 1 cubic foot per second for 40 acres or 1/40th of a CFS per acre and 3.5 acre feet per acre as a duty. These are higher than necessary, and they exceed the contractual rate and duty within the Klamath project as we understand it, which is typically the duty is set at 2.5 to 3 acre feet per acre where duty is specified in the contract. In other adjudications that we are aware of, the rate and duty typically awarded are 1 cubic foot per second for 80 acres or 1/80th of a CFS per acre. And where 1/40th CFS is granted, that rate typically applies only until June 15th of the irrigation season. To our knowledge, irrigators within the Klamath Project have never diverted 3.5 acre feet per acre in any irrigation year, although somebody may correct me on that. So this excessive rate and duty that is coming out through the adjudication is yet another example of the state giving away this precious public resource rather than managing it aggressively. There is really no reasonable explanation for this outcome, and it will eventually exacerbate the water crisis in the basin. Finally, we dispute that the state lacks management tools right now to take some measures to address the water crisis in the basin. Measurement of water in the Klamath is almost non-existent. There is really no measurement of water that's being used under pre-1909 claims that are unadjudicated. There is almost no measurement of water used pursuant to post-1909 water rights, but pre-1993 water rights. There may be a few post-1993 water rights that have a condition of measurement in the permit. And while irrigation districts typically measure water at the initial point of diversion, there is really no measurement internal to the irrigation district once the water passes the initial point of diversion. There also may have been a few headgate notices in the basin issued by the department, although we are unaware of them, except in the Wood River subbasin, which is a good object lesson for how the department could be doing more management in the basin. In the Wood, Water Watch went out and measured diversions on throughout the Wood subbasin and did a report and took it to the department. And the result of that was the department eventually issued headgate notices to irrigators within the Wood Basin. Once those headgates were installed, we saw stream flows in the Wood increase by about 30 cubic feet per second the following year and subsequently. There are some who dispute whether there's a cause and effect relationship between headgates and increased stream flows, but we are fairly certain of the cause and effect there. So in closing, I would just like to note that what gets measured gets managed, and in the Klamath, measurement would go a long way to helping the management problem that currently exists down there. I appreciate your consideration of these comments and appreciate your time and listening. Thank you.
Doug?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Doug Myers, and I'm here today representing the Klamath Tribes. I should also tell you that one of my other clients is Trout Unlimited, which is a nationwide organization for cold water fish, who is very active in the lower Klamath, around the Trinity River, where the fish kill was, etc. But they don't take part in the adjudication. The Klamath Tribes and Water Watch do. So please ignore the this is taken off an email to me, and I couldn't get the original email, which was sent to me in MIME format. And believe me, it was about 35 pages of nothing but meaningless characters. So it was sent this way, so just ignore that. And start in sort of in the middle of the page. The Klamath Basin adjudication is in its administrative phase, where hundreds of contested cases are being processed through hearings before the Office of Administrative Hearings. The OAH and the Water Resources Department and the Klamath Basin water claimants have made considerable progress toward completion of these cases since the hearings began in 2001. This, so far, the OAH has been focused on non-tribal water rights. Now they're turning their attention to the water rights of the Klamath Tribes, which are some of the most complex and important cases in the adjudication. And this is real important because water law and use of water is essentially governed by your priority date, which states, which is first in time, first in right. The priority date for the Klamath Tribes is from time immemorial. It doesn't say 1905, doesn't say 1899, doesn't say 1923. It's from time immemorial, which trumps everybody else. So it is very important. And so 4 years into the hearings in the first part of this year, the OAH issued a letter informing the adjudication participants that regardless of the number and complexity of the cases remaining, those cases, especially those involving the tribe's water rights, will be accelerated to whatever extent necessary in order to complete them all by the end of '07. This may sound like a long time, but given the amount of work the cases require and the time previously allowed for non-tribal cases, it is a very short time period indeed. It amounts to a dramatic acceleration of the adjudication proceedings without any equivalent ability of the parties to deal faster with the work at hand. KBA cases of comparable complexity have all been allowed 35 to 40 months for their litigation. Under the current order, once prerequisites are satisfied, the tribe's claims must be processed in 3 to 12 months. This letter was issued without consultation with affected parties and without warning. The order was objected to by virtually all parties, including a couple of weeks ago, as you heard from the Water for Life participants, both tribal and non-tribal. We asked that they reconsider, and last week we learned they refused. This is troubling, first, because it is simply not possible to do the enormous amount of required work with an accelerated schedule. The tribal water rights cases are the most complex cases remaining to be scheduled in the KBA, and they involve the largest and most complex claims of the entire adjudication. The tribal cases present technical and scientific issues not encountered elsewhere, and in many ways foreign to the experience of the Water Resources Department and the hearing officers. For example, these cases involve in-stream flows and marsh claims unique in the KBA.
These claims will require experts in a number of disciplines, including hydrologists, fish biologists, wildlife biologists, plant specialists, and others. Moreover, the cases will require extraordinary document production and review and exchange of information among the parties. Written discovery cannot be propounded and responded to in an extremely compressed calendar. The sheer number of participants on all sides in the tribal cases requires complex case management. While the tribes themselves are relatively well organized, there are many disparate non-tribal participants, some of whom are organized in the groups while others are not. These include consortiums of non-tribal interest who require time for internal coordination and consultation amongst themselves. And a large number of contestants are, at least at this point, proceeding without lawyer representation, which will call into play the hearing officer's patience with non-legally trained participants. Second, the unfairness of the accelerated schedule falls disproportionately on the tribes and their tribal and their property rights. Because the tribes' cases were scheduled to be among the last to be adjudicated, they are particularly vulnerable to prejudice caused by a premature hearing date. It now appears that because they are the last to be scheduled, they will be compressed into schedules that other people's claims have not had to endure. Other people's cases were scheduled with attention to their cases' needs and complexities and the goals of fairness. They were allowed to proceed accordingly, and we approve of that. Now, when the tribes' cases approach hearing, those values are being moved aside. This is wrong. The explanation for this by the OAH has nothing to do with fairness or providing an effective forum. Instead, the reasons appear to be simply administrative preference and expedience. These, of course, are not illegitimate concerns in themselves, but when those concerns threaten to deprive the parties of a fair and effective forum, as they do here, they raise serious questions of due process. The adjudication is a complicated undertaking which cannot be simplified and should not be expedited by edict. Moreover, if the cases are required to be prepared on an impossible schedule, it will deny the tribes their right to full and fairly adjudicate their water rights in the administrative proceeding. Further, an inadequate administrative proceeding can delay the ultimate conclusion of the adjudication by necessitating additional proceedings before the circuit court or by requiring remand to the Water Resources Department.
Could you wrap up in a couple of minutes?
I have four lines, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
In sum, the tribes want this committee to know the acceleration of the Klamath Basin adjudication is unreasonable, unfair, and unjustified. The tribes and other KBA parties will be weighing their response options in the coming weeks and will do what they can to assure that the adjudication provides a fair and effective opportunity for the tribes and others to protect and resolve their property rights in the basin. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'm going to bang the gavel.
Just a question. Who is Carl Ullman?
Carl Bud Ullman is the attorney for the Klamath Tribes, and he is the one representing them in the adjudication.
Thank you.
He would be here, except he's in Boulder as we speak.
Okay.
To announce that Senate Bill 940 will be carried over to Monday, May 16th, and we're going to close the informational meeting on the Klamath Basin adjudication, with that, we are going to be adjourned for this day, May 11th.